Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week we turn to the book of Jeremiah, chapters 36 and 31, in which God commands Jeremiah to write a scroll of prophecy, and yet promises to write a new covenant directly on the hearts of the people. We think about the king's attempt to suppress the truth by burning it, and the irrepressible power of the word set free among the people. Also, we talk more than we probably should about the Spice Girls. Zig, Ziga. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this morning?
I am doing okay. How are you, Bobby?
I am doing well.
I just need to tell everyone who is tuning in about, I need to give like a high level summary of the conversation we just had. Like we log in a little early and are like setting up our microphones and, you know, whatever, and chit-chatting. And somehow the conversation went from Bobby saying, Zoom is on, to saying, that reminds me of the Spice Girls. Which
Zoom on.
That is what it reminded Bobby of. And then he started thinking, what was the phrase in the Spice Girls song? It was like, Zigga Zigga. And he Googled it, and he found information about that phrase that is not family friendly, and we cannot relay it per our agreement with iTunes.
We promised iTunes that we would never swear on this show, and therefore, we cannot tell you the origins of the phrase Zigga Zigga in the Spice Girls' famous ballad, Tell Me What You Want. Is that the name of that song?
I have no idea what
tell
that song is
Tell
you
what I want, what I really, really want.
But that information is available to you on Google.
Oh, it's called Wannabe. That song is called
to
Wannabe.
Search
it shows
for
you
it.
How into the Spice Girls we really are.
Oh, man.
Okay, so today we're in the book of Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be in 36, 1 to 10, 21 to 28, and then 31, 31 to 34. What do we need to know to make sense of this passage from Jeremiah?
So here are some things that I would want to know. The time period that we're looking at for Jeremiah starts around the reign of King Josiah, which is 627 or so BCE. The claim to fame of King Josiah was sort of quote unquote finding the book of Deuteronomy, finding the Torah, and trying to implement all the changes that are in there, centralization of the cult. And then Jeremiah continues through the reign of Josiah's son, Jehoiakim. And then all the way up through when the Jerusalem temple is destroyed in 586 BCE. And then the last thing I would add is just that the book of Jeremiah is not necessarily chronological. Like it's sort of more topically oriented than necessarily tracing exactly some kind of chronology. And I mention that mostly because, as you said, the text we get from the narrative lectionary starts us in chapter 36, but then throws us back a couple chapters earlier, which I guess would seem stranger to me if it were clearly a chronological text, but it's not clearly a chronological text.
All right, so we'll just start then in 36. I'm going to read 1 to 3. In the fourth year of King Jehoiakim, son of Josiah of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Take a scroll and write on it all the words that I have spoken to you against Israel and Judah, and all the nations, from the day I spoke to you, from the days of Josiah until today. It may be that when the house of Judah hears of all the disasters that I intend to do to them, all of them may turn from their evil ways, so that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. Okay, so we get kind of a specific dating of this text right here in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Is there any significance to that date?
Yeah, so that places us around 605 BCE, mm-hmm. right? And this is the year that the Babylonians defeated Egypt and sort of took control over Judah.
Yeah.
So things are happening in their political world. Like there's a lot going on. Jeremiah has an oracle elsewhere in his book sort of proclaiming that there will be a 70-year period of Babylonian rule. And so it may be that starts now.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've always thought that, that prophecy just missed the mark a little bit. But if you start it now, then it comes actually pretty close.
Yeah, closer, yeah.
Because it lasts till the time of Cyrus in 538. So like 65, 70, like that's kind of...
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Kind of close, yeah.
What would you add about the context that we're in here at this time?
The only other thing I'd say, Jehoiakim is the son of Josiah. Mm-hmm. Josiah was the great reforming king, as you know, who about 15 years before this had undertaken a reform to sort of bring Judah in line with the book of Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. And so Josiah was kind of seen as a great hero of the Deuteronomistic history, that he had really established God's rule in a different kind of way in Judah. But we get the notice that Jehoiakim, in 2 Kings, we get the notice that Jehoiakim is bad, like all the other kings of Judah are thought to be bad by 2 Kings.
Yeah, and isn't there, at least when we were reading Isaiah, wasn't there some sense that Egypt in particular, like there was a faction within Judah that wanted to align with Egypt? Egypt seemed like if they could ally with Egypt, then they could preserve the status quo. But Isaiah and Jeremiah both are saying, you know, Egypt is not the ticket here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That Isaiah was pretty negative about all alliances.
Yeah.
Jeremiah is a little more, I mean, you kind of read him, pro-Babylonian might be a little bit strong, but like kind of the overarching message of his book turns out to be like, Babylon's going to conquer you and God's going to, like God is in charge of that because God is punishing you. And so you just need to submit to Babylonian rule. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly pro-Babylonian, but it sort of politically is a little bit that way.
Yeah. So history has started to align here with what Jeremiah and Isaiah have been saying, that Egypt is not the ticket.
So the command here is from God is to write down all the words that I have spoken to you from the days of Josiah until today.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, so we're in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. Jeremiah has been prophesying. In Jeremiah 25:3, we get the notice that Jeremiah has been prophesying for like 23 years at this point.
So just write all that stuff down.
Like, I couldn't write down things that I was thinking about, like, last week.
I know, it's crazy. It is crazy. And yes, both the fact that that's, you know, just remember all those things I said to you these past 20 years and write them all down. And also, this is only halfway through his term as a prophet,
he's got another 20 years to go.
He's got another 20 years to go. But it's a pretty crazy command that he gets.
So the reason that Jeremiah is supposed to write this down is so that the house of Judah may hear it of all the disasters that God is going to do to them. Mm-hmm. And so they may repent and be forgiven. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about just the content of like why Jeremiah is asked to do this?
You know, in Isaiah, the text we read last week, now that I'm thinking about it, it is much more like just you have to tell the people this is going to happen, but it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, but here in Jeremiah, there really is a very explicit possibility to turn things around.
Yeah. So God here is trying to warn Judah so that Judah will repent. And so this thing that Jeremiah sees coming maybe doesn't have to come to fruition. I think that's right. There, at this moment in the text, there is still the possibility of repentance. Okay. So picking up in verse 4. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote on a scroll at Jeremiah's dictation all the words of the Lord that he had spoken to him. And Jeremiah ordered Baruch, saying, I am prevented from entering the house of the Lord, so you go yourself, and on a fast day, in the hearing of the people in the Lord's house, you shall read the words of the Lord from the scroll that you have written at my dictation. You shall read them also in the hearing of all the people of Judah who come up from their towns. It may be that their plea will come before the Lord, and that all of them will turn from their evil ways, for great is the anger and wrath that the Lord has pronounced against his people. And Baruch, son of Neriah, did all that the prophet Jeremiah ordered him about reading from the scroll, the words of the Lord in the Lord's house. So Baruch is supposed to go down to, well, first of all, Jeremiah says, I am prevented from entering the house of the Lord. So Jeremiah can't go and deliver this to the people himself. I struggled to find anything about why couldn't Jeremiah go to the house of the Lord. What did you come up with anything about that?
I mean, it's interesting. My translation says, I am in hiding. I cannot go to the house of the Lord. So I got a sense from that. And especially as it, you know, as it goes on and Baruch also has to go into hiding, that Jeremiah knows that this message is not going to be welcome and is going to put him in danger as the messenger.
Yeah, Jeremiah is in trouble kind of a lot in this book because King Jehoiakim does not appreciate, as we're going to see here in a minute, does not appreciate the policy positions that Jeremiah seems to be advocating. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so he's already gotten himself in some kind of trouble and is not able to go out into public. And so this makes me really kind of admire Baruch because Jeremiah's like, look, Baruch, like, saying this stuff the first time got me in so much trouble. I can't, like, go out in public. So now you go do it.
Yeah.
And so Baruch is taking some personal risk here to go and do this thing.
No, that's absolutely right.
So in verse 6, Jeremiah tells Baruch to go to the house of the Lord on a fast day in the hearing of the people. And then we get this sort of notice. You read it in the hearing of all the people of Judah who come up from their towns.
It's so interesting to me, you know, very much counter to the book of Jonah, where Jonah doesn't want to offer this prophecy and doesn't want people to hear it and, you know, thinks this is all a big waste of time. You know, Jeremiah is really envisioning getting this information to the maximum number of people. And so it is not only go to the temple and read it to the people who serve the temple or whoever happens to be there. It's wait for a fast day. And fast days are, you know, days of some contrition or a sense of mourning or pleading or sorrow.
Yeah.
And so I envision that it's a fast day when people have come from all around to the temple in this moment of contrition. And then they will hear these prophecies. So maybe, I mean, not only would you get the maximum number of ears, but the people who are coming that day are maybe oriented towards reflecting on how they're not doing such a good job.
I mean, there's this really interesting kind of struggle that's being set up here. Like, there's the people of Judah, and then there is the, like, the king of Judah. Mm-hmm. And they're not exactly, like, all this on the same page. So Jeremiah has gone, like, taken it directly to the people first. And then it's only going to get to the king in this next section because some of the officials overhear. Any thoughts about that sort of that move of, like, don't take it to the policymakers, take it to the people?
That's so interesting. You know, and I hadn't thought about that question on my first reading of it. But it really does. I mean, it makes sense in that what is being prophesied is largely, like, the direction that is being set by your leadership is incredibly dangerous to you as, you know, Joe Israel.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but if you deliver to that immediately to the people who are in power, it's a, I don't know, a harsher critique maybe of the leadership than just of the individual. But every individual is deeply impacted by the decisions of the leadership. So I don't know, maybe there's a thought that if you bring it to the king first, it may never get to the people.
Yeah.
And if you bring it to the people first, maybe there can be some additional pressure on the king that this has to be taken seriously.
Yeah. So sort of a grassroots movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
If you can sway the people, then they can pressure the king or something like that.
Yes, exactly.
So it's interesting to me that what is being read now is prophecies that have already been prophesied over the last 23 years.
A long time ago. Yeah.
So Jeremiah is not prophesying and Baruch is not speaking out in public. I think anything new, this is just like recapitulating things that have been prophesied over quite some period of time, but now they're being spoken anew and written down.
Yeah.
And Jeremiah's hoping they're going to have some kind of effect now.
Yeah.
Do you have any ways of thinking about that? It's like the old is doing something new, or like, how do you make sense of that?
I mean, I wonder if part of it has to do with the historical circumstance, because the people can see maybe some connection to these older prophecies against alliances with Egypt.
Yeah.
Maybe having that little bit of like, oh, well, that part turned out to be true. Or, you know, like it seems like there's truth in here. So maybe we need to pay a different kind of attention to it now. But I also wonder how much the people of Israel really had heard this.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it was hard to get word out. There was no like Twitter.
Yeah. Sometimes I wish there were no Twitter now, too. But
here
we find ourselves. Yeah.
I know.
I mean, in some ways, this is what we do every Sabbath, right, in both our traditions, where we take this ancient text and we re-speak the words, and the claim is these words are going to have a new effect in the world based on like where we find ourselves at this moment.
Yeah.
The kind of belief in our traditions is the words continue to have effect in the world, even though they were actually written some or spoken some time ago.
That's really beautiful that the sense of truth in the words resonates only more deeply or sort of increases in its range of resonance as time goes on.
So picking up in verse 9, in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim, son of Josiah of Judah, in the ninth month, all the people in Jerusalem and all the people who came from the towns of Judah to Jerusalem proclaimed a fast before the Lord. Then in the hearing of all the people, Baruch read the words of Jeremiah from the scroll, in the house of the Lord, in the chamber of Gemariah, son of Shaphan the secretary, which was in the upper court at the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house. So the one thing that I just kind of noticed about this is Jeremiah was told to write things down in the fourth year of Jehoiakim.
Yeah.
Baruch actually reads them out in the fifth year of Jehoiakim.
Uh-huh.
And it's in the ninth month. It's not like he got the prophecy like at the end of year four and read it in the beginning.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about that timing?
I mean, I also had noted like either it took a year to write down all the stuff that they wrote down, which, I mean, is 20 years of prophecy. And I imagine that it wasn't just sort of a constant. It's not like it was necessarily at the tip of Jeremiah's tongue. Like, you'd have to kind of, I don't know, like, it was a project to dictate and write all of that stuff. Although I also noticed that it says they proclaimed a fast. Like, that makes it sound to me like it wasn't necessarily this standing fast day.
Yeah.
Maybe they proclaimed a fast in response to something in the world, and sort of like Baruch and Jeremiah were waiting for their moment. And that was the moment, you know, like they maybe had the scroll ready and said, okay, now they've proclaimed a fast. They see that something is not going well and they feel a need to come to God in contrition. And so this is our moment. So I don't know who knows how long they were waiting.
I really like that interpretation a lot. But I mean, both of that, like A, this is substantive and it took them a while to pull it together. But I really like that interpretation of they were waiting for a fast day to be proclaimed. And so there's something in there about like doing the work, but waiting for the right moment. So you're like when the moment arises, you're ready to go. And that seems to be maybe what Jeremiah and Baruch have done here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you envision what Baruch is doing? It says he's in the chamber of Gemariah in the upper court at the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house. How do you envision?
What's happening here?
Yeah.
I envision that Gemariah was sort of, I don't know, a gatekeeper in terms of what happens, but someone like a lead scribe. And so all of the content would sort of have to come through him in some way, but it doesn't describe what kind of interaction they've had, if any. It just says that he's in Gemariah's space.
Yeah, I know that's interesting because it does seem like Gemariah would have had to, I would assume, given him permission to speak from his chamber.
Yeah. We would assume,
and so there has been some sort of official process of saying, yes, you are allowed to have this space to speak to the people.
And, you know, we know from a different chapter in Jeremiah, from chapter 26, that Gemariah is generally sympathetic to Jeremiah's cause. He intercedes on the prophet's behalf at his sedition trial. So maybe he just was sort of a friendly insider that Baruch could start with.
So we're going to skip down to verse 21. But in the middle there, I think it's interesting in the very next verse, Gemariah's son Micaiah hears what Baruch is reading from Gemariah's chamber and goes and gathers the officials and says, hey, y'all, I'm not sure that Baruch ought to be able to say these things like in public. So they get together and they go and report Baruch to the king, who calls for the scroll to be brought to him. And so in the reading out of this scroll of Jeremiah, Baruch has been overheard by an insider and now is, I don't think Baruch gets called before the king, it seems like, but the scroll gets brought to the king. Is that how you read what's going on?
That last part is how I read what's going on, but my reading of the section right before that was more that they heard what was happening and they said, like, uh-oh, you know, we need to be paying attention to what is in this scroll.
Oh.
And then, you know, they gather the people, they read the scroll to them, and they say, we have to report all of this to the king. Like, this is serious. This is serious.
That is so interesting because I feel like the text is wide open about what the source of their alarm is.
I think you're exactly right. I think that, you know, it says that, yes, they are alarmed, and it says they feel fear, and this has to be reported to the king. But you're right. It is not clear whether they feel alarm that this sort of inciting text has been read to the people, or whether they are afraid of the words of the text itself.
That's what, and it really changes a lot about what you think about what happens next. But I think that's interesting to hold open those two possibilities. One, that they're saying like, oh my gosh, we need to do something about this. Let's take this to the king so the king can get us all straightened out. Mm-hmm. Or, oh my gosh, this is seditious and we need to take this to the king so the king can suppress what is being said. That's really fascinating.
And it's interesting to wonder about the ways in which those fears can butt right up against each other. Like when words of this kind of power and import are read before a crowd, that you could both feel fear about the chaos that those words might, you know, stir up, and also have this fear that maybe they're true.
Yeah.
And it sort of is like, which fear is going to drive you?
Okay, so what happens next then is we're going to skip down to verse 21, and where we're going to sort of move into the king's chambers and see what happens in there. Then the king sent Yehudi to get the scroll, and he took it from the chamber of Elishama the secretary, and Yehudi read it to the king and all the officials who stood beside the king. Now the king was sitting in his winter apartment, it was the ninth month, and there was a fire burning in the brazier before him. As Yehudi read three or four columns, the king would cut them off with a penknife and throw them into the fire in the brazier, until the entire scroll was consumed in the fire that was in the brazier. Yet neither the king nor any of his servants who heard all these words was alarmed, nor did they tear their garments. Even when Elnathan and Deliah and Gemariah urged the king not to burn the scroll, he would not listen to them. And the king commanded Jeremiel, the king's son, and Sariah, son of Azrael, and Shelemiah, son of Abdiel, to arrest the secretary Baruch and the prophet Jeremiah, but the Lord hid them. All right, so what we get here is the king is listening to the scroll being read, and he is cutting it off a few columns at a time and throwing it into the fire. What do you do with this scene?
It puts me back in some ways to the detail that we received earlier of how long it took Jeremiah and Baruch to make this scroll.
Yeah.
And that Jeremiah has gone back through 20 years of pretty traumatic prophetic experiences.
Yes.
And dictated them to Baruch, who has carefully written them out, and they've waited for this special day. And then there's just this description of such great violence against the scroll itself.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, and he destroyed it.
Yeah.
You know, it's this careful desecration of the scroll, first cutting the words apart from each other and then throwing them into the fire. And I just think of all the energy and faith and fear and love that had been heaped up into that scroll and the way that it is so utterly destroyed by the king. It's very distressing.
There's that line in there that none of them who read the words was alarmed or tore their garments. Which mm-hmm. makes it feel like, I mean, almost like the king is not ripping this, cutting it in like anger or like, it, you know, it's like, it's almost this kind of casual, like,
this is so
like,
stupid.
Burn.
Yeah.
Like the coldness of it or something mm-hmm. in what he's doing.
You're right. And in some ways, I think there's a real tension in there. Like if he really thought the scroll had no particular importance, why expend that much energy to symbolically pull it apart and destroy it so intentionally? But it's both. They both don't show any deference to it, but they also go out of their ways to desecrate it.
Yeah.
I can't help but being struck also that, at least in my translation, when it describes that he is cutting apart the verses themselves, the columns, it says that he uses a scribe's knife.
Oh, yeah. And the NRSV was pen knife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, again, it keeps throwing me back to this idea of what is it to be a scribe? What is the written word? What is the relationship of the written word? And sort of what tools does it bring? And I don't know. It just is, the scroll is destroyed by the same set of tools that would bring it to exist in the first place. Like a scribe's knife, they would cut out mistakes, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he's cutting out the whole thing as a mistake.
That is so interesting. And that, you know, one of the things that's happening in this text, and it'll get amplified here in just a minute when we read the rest of the text, but is this like the status of written words versus the status of unwritten things?
Yeah.
And the turning of the tools of writing against writing.
Yeah.
Like, all of that is so interesting. And it really seems like the king thinks that if he destroys this scroll, then the scroll doesn't have any power anymore.
Right. Right.
And I mean, a little bit maybe he thinks it never had any power because he's not really alarmed by what it says. But there's this sense of like, if we could just throw this thing in the fire, then it won't be a problem for us anymore.
Right.
So this story ends. I'm going to read 27 to 28, and then I'm just going to add verse 32 because I think it's a nice concluding verse.
Because you'll like it. Okay.
Yeah. Picking up in 27. Now, after the king had burned the scroll with the words that Baruch wrote at Jeremiah's dictation, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. Take another scroll and write on it all the former words that were burned in the first scroll, which King Jehoiakim of Judah has burned. Then Jeremiah took another scroll and gave it to the secretary Baruch, son of Neriah, who wrote on it, at Jeremiah's dictation, all the words of the scroll that King Jehoiakim of Judah had burned in the fire, and many similar words were added to them. So Jeremiah has just spent 9 months of his life, or however long it's been, a year of his life, writing this scroll. It gets burned. Immediately the command comes to write it again. Any thoughts about that process or that command? Like, there's some value in the written text, or God wouldn't keep commanding it to be written down, right?
Yeah, although the first thought that I had was sort of going back to where you just ended, this idea that the power of the truth in those words doesn't go away just because you burn the scroll.
Yes.
You rewrite it on another scroll and even adds more like it, expands upon it. You can't. You know, it's like the king is envisioning that by carving up the scroll and burning it, he has defeated the oracles.
Yeah.
Like, he has challenged the truth of them. And this is saying very much no.
Yeah, that's right. The words continue to have power because they're in Jeremiah's heart or they're in his soul or wherever they are. In his mind, he can bring them out again. And I love that point you're adding. Many similar words were added to them, which means like maybe the king actually made it worse by burning it, because now there's even more prophecy about the king. All right, well, in the narrative lectionary, we're going to jump to a prophecy, which is probably one of the most famous prophecies in the book of Jeremiah. Maybe one of the most famous prophecies, kind of generally speaking, in the Hebrew Bible. But in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, says the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall they teach one another or say to one another, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, says the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. So we get this prophecy here of a new covenant that's going to come into being that displaces the previous covenant. Mm-hmm. How can you help us just start thinking about the significance of that?
Well, here's where my head is when I read those words. So the book of Deuteronomy in particular, although other places also in the Hebrew Bible, describe like a very clear sort of like old-fashioned covenantal relationship between the people Israel and God. And God has certain responsibilities to Israel, and Israel has certain responsibilities to God. And then there are many texts afterwards that just show the many, many ways in which the people of Israel are just not able to live up to their end of the covenant.
Yeah.
What's being described here sounds to me different than a new covenant, though. It sounds like a different, like, it sounds like I'm going to create a different kind of human. Like, I'm going to go back to the story of Adam and Eve and say, you don't have free will.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think when you read this text? Where do you start?
This reminds me a little bit of Deuteronomy 6 and the binding on the hands and on the forehead and on the doorpost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that move is like, surround yourself with the Torah all the time so that you're constantly reminded of it.
Yeah.
And this is just like one step kind of past that. Like,
yes.
Okay, like, I'm just going to put it on in there so you don't have to be a, like, pay attention to this external authority. You're going to have it in your heart.
Following up on the conversation we just had about the words, the truth of Jeremiah's prophecies being so deeply embedded in his person and so much bigger and deeper than anything you can write on a scroll. And the first scroll is destroyed, but it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't do anything to impact the truth. And then reading this text where it's like this written covenant that, you know, is in the book of Deuteronomy, but they also, like, you write words on the scroll in the mezuzah. Like, you write words.
Yeah.
And you attach, you know, like, you attach them to your doorpost. You attach them to your body. You do everything you can to put them close to you. But this is saying, just like the truth of these things was embodied in Jeremiah, the truth of these things will be embodied in you. So you can't forget them. You know, I always read Deuteronomy 6 a little bit as like, put a post-it note on your bathroom mirror, like tie a string around your finger. Like, you're going to need help remembering this. And here are all the ways you can help yourself. But you can still ignore the post-it note on your mirror. I mean, you can.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just that sense of the truth being written within us. And then whatever's written outside of us as a reflection of whatever is within us, instead of trying to internalize something that started outside of us.
I really love that. And, you know, it's in keeping with this text. Like, when in the previous part of the passage, when the scroll was burned, God didn't say, like, that's fine, you didn't really need that scroll anyway, right? God said, you've got to write those words down again, even though you are going to have this new covenant in your heart. Like, they both matter. And so having this sort of new orientation or this new ability to internalize what is written, I really love that interpretation, because I think that brings together these kind of two emphases on the written text and then on the kind of the inner orientation. It's not that one is replacing the other, but that they're both necessary in some way. I really love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, Amy, so when you think back on this whole passage that we've read in chapter 36 and now 31, and you're thinking about contemporary life and your community, where do you see the connections between this text and today?
Well, I can't help but be drawn to this question about truth and writing and who is the holder of the truth and who has access to that truth as it plays out really in the days of Twitter and Facebook and disinformation. I mean, the verses that we skipped today between 11 and 20, there's a section where the sort of the scribes of the temple ask Baruch, tell us exactly what the process was for writing down these words. Like, what is your source of this information?
Yeah.
Like, they really are trying to discern what's true here. And there was such an earnest effort put forth by Jeremiah and Baruch and all those scribes, but then it reached a certain level of power and was just torn up and thrown away, which has huge impact in our moment in our lives. And also, as we see in this text, has no impact in terms of what is actually true or not. You can't make something true or not true by refusing to acknowledge it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like we live in this moment. Maybe everyone feels this way, but I really feel like we live in this moment where it is so hard to know what's true. And the democratization of communication, maybe of media, has in some ways been really fantastic, because anyone can put their truth out there for to be received by whoever wants to receive it. But there also is, there's no group of scribes saying, where did this scroll come from? Tell us exactly where this information came from before we go and take it to the king and say, this is something we need to listen to. So I guess it just has me thinking a lot about who gets to write a scroll and who gets to read the scroll in public, and the ways in which our power structures do help, you know, do help to sort of vet that information like the scribes do, and also don't, like the king.
Yeah.
That's not an inspiring message, but it's something to think about.
One of the things that's really interesting when you think about the text that way is that, I mean, Baruch has gone to the people first, mm-hmm. and he has read out the passage, and then the king burns the scroll, mm-hmm. right? And so the word is already out there in the world. And so by the time the king gets to destroy the word is already at work in the world. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really interesting notion in this text that the powers, the forces that try to control what truth can be communicated are thwarted in this text by the public proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying about the democratization of who gets to say what and who gets to control what, I think that's so fascinating, because in this text, if that had gone through proper channels, the scroll would have gotten burned before it ever was read in public.
No, you're right.
Like, when you ask the question, like, Baruch, what is the source of your prophecy, or what is the source of the scroll? And he's going to say, well, I mean, God talks to my boss.
Right, you know, and like, then my boss read all those words to me and I wrote them down.
Yeah. And so like, okay, like maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true. Like at some point, what we're having to do is to commit to our sources of truth.
That's right. That's right. And decide what we will take as a legitimate source of truth and what we won't.
And one of the things that I love about this text is that it seems to suggest that if we really, as people of faith, internalize the words that we hear, the words that we read in the Torah, if we rely on God to sort of put those words in our heart, that we will know what is true. And we'll be able to live our lives with this internalized truth in a way that sort of makes us impervious to these alternative truths that that vie for our attention. And then I think in Jeremiah 31 that ultimately the goal is the living out of this internalized truth that looks a lot like the covenanted community that is envisioned in the Torah, in the book of Deuteronomy. Like that is, like we've got to be committed to that kind of internal sense of what is right. And when other people have claims on what rightness looks like for those of us in our traditions, coming back to that in, that vision of a covenanted community that does justice for the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, and where all people sort of have access to the shared resources of a community, like I think that's where we come back to.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And discernment never gets to leave the picture for us. Like we will always have that's to exactly actively right. discern what that looks like in our moment. And there will always be some other voice saying, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
It's complicated stuff.
It is complicated, but kind of beautiful in its own way. All right, Amy. So next week we are in Daniel chapter 6, verses 6 to 27, which is the story of Daniel in the lion's den.
Yes. So dramatic.
Indeed. Well, this has been a fun conversation. And
ziggity zoo. How did you start this?
Zigga-zigga.
Zigga-zigga. Yeah. Yeah.
I was trying to figure out a way to work around a zigga-zigga, but I couldn't come up with a smooth segue.
Mine was really smooth.
Yeah. What was that thing?
Ziggity zoo? Zoobly zoo?
Zooma zooma.
Zoobly zoo. Oh, this used to be a TV show. Excellent. The word of Jeremiah the bullfrog is ziggity zoo.
Ziggity zoo.
Yeah.
All right, Amy.
I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are so grateful to all our supporters for helping us to keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest sponsors, Hope Montgomery, Heather Tadlock, and Gretchen Wagner.
Join us next week as we'll be discussing the story of Daniel in the lion's den in Daniel chapter 6. Until then, keep on digging.